Hello, I'm Kelly Gardner and you're listening to Imagining the Past. Imagining the Past is a sneak preview of some of the writers and issues showcased in this year's conference of the Historical Novel Society of Australasia. In Parramatta, New South Wales, from the 25th to the 27th of October 2019, the conference offers craft workshops and 2 days of panel sessions, interviews and conversations. It's for writers and readers of historical fiction. You'll hear from a huge range of authors, Jackie French, Paula Morris, Anna Campbell, Marie Mankara, Pamela Hart, Ali Elizadeh, Meg Keneally, Kate Forsyth, and many more. The weekend also features academic panels and demonstrations of historical weapons. You can find out more at hnsa.org.au. In this podcast series, I'll be talking to some of our conference guests about writing and reading historical fiction. Today's guest is one of Australia's favourite authors and our guest of honour at the 2019 conference, Jackie French. Jackie French has written over 200 books for readers of all ages, and many of them are historical fiction. She has sold millions of copies and won awards all over the world. Her honours include the Order of Australia and Senior Australian of the Year, and from 2014 to 2015, she was the Australian Children's Laureate. We spoke to her on the line from her home in the Araluen Valley, where she enjoys her famous garden and orchard and daily visits from wombats. You might have read a book or two about them too. What is it about stories about the past that makes you want to write them?
I think for me it is a love of truth, an incredibly deep love of truth. I'm one of those people who will not only tell the truth and nothing but the truth, but probably bore you for 2 hours telling the whole truth. I think people read historical fiction for two reasons. One is escapism, and where it's escapism, that can be actually where you go for the bodice ripper, the generic medieval thing, which is not set at any particular time. But it really is just the world of imagination with some historical, vague historical inaccurate elements added to it. The past, of course, is also probably the best escape when it is realistic, because the real past, the truth of the past, is so much more exciting and so different from the present that it is even more fascinating and even more an escape. There are very few writers, I mean, Hilary Mantel, etc., and the wonderful brother Cadfael Vieres, people who are able to take not just the historical detail, but also the historical motivations, because the reasons people acted, the way they thought in the past, is so very different from today. And also to even the small details, and that's one of the wonderful things too in Mantel's work, is where light is different. When you're talking about palace conspiracies, you're talking about a place which, particularly in England, is actually dark, with small pools of light, both literally and metaphorically, as people have got candles of good quality if they're beeswax, poor quality if they're tallow, spluttering if they're reused tallow. But they are these small pools of light that people work in. Historical fiction isn't something that you can really do just with research, but I think all too many people do it. There is a reasonably well-known book that well-meaning people have been sending me over the past couple of months, saying, oh, this is a wonderful book, and each time I have tried to read it again and I have got onto the third page and just been so irritated by what the author did not know about the time, that there weren't pockets, that women would not have shaken hands. They would have actually sort of bobbed a curtsy. That there is no way in that time and place that a man who had just met a woman would have actually dropped a kiss onto her cheek, etc. The sorts of things where you just know that this is not the way the past was. And when the writer is trying to recreate something that really happened, you know, if they have got all of these very small things wrong, there is no way they're going to be able to understand the motivations of people in what was a real time. Sometimes, for me, even when I was very young, in fact, even I think when I was about 3, it's almost as though there is a whisper saying, remember me, remember me. And this isn't just that the past provides us with a few interesting elements to build our own edifice of fiction on, but that we owe a duty to the past to be accurate. Now, this isn't saying that we have to tell the whole truth. The whole truth can be very, very boring. I'm a great advocate of being selective in what we tell. That's what a book is, that's what a play is. It's basically taking out all the boring bits, the getting up, the stretching, the moving the toes, even the cutting of the toenails, etc., all of which was done back then, and only leaving in the interesting bits. You don't have to put the 10 minutes of considering what sort of jam I'm going to have on my toast, or even if it's going to be toast or not. Of course you don't tell the whole truth. Of course you only choose the most dramatic truth, the most pertinent truth, the most vivid truth, the most fulfilling truth, or for that matter, the truth that you want to tell. But you're selecting from the truth. You're not adding to it. You're not changing it. You're not taking it away. You're certainly not changing it. And to do that, you need to know your subject well enough to know what you don't know. Do they have a scullery maid back then? Do women wear pockets? How do you drop your skirt, getting 6 inches of crud from emptied chamber pots and horse droppings and all of the other muck that's in the street? For that matter, when you're walking down the street, how deep is that street in rubbish? And so, no, you simply don't have your heroine with her train being dragged down the street, because otherwise when she arrives at the hero's house, she's going to pong something awful. And she will not be accepted as a lady.
Oh, there's so much to unpack in that, and that's all fascinating. So I was just rereading Hitler's Daughter recently and noticing how much it is about storytelling and how stories make us feel, and making a direct connection between past and present, because the boy in that book, the boy Mark, listens to the story, gets all curious about the Second World War, and then he goes home and there's a new war and a new genocide on the TV news. And so you're also making that connection, aren't you, between truths past and present and the relevance of the past to our lives now.
Yes, I don't think we cannot understand the present without understanding how we got here. Otherwise, we're just in this tiny little isolated box. It's like waking up one morning with no memory of yesterday, no idea if the person across the breakfast table is actually a friend or a foe, is going to poison us or give us something delicious for breakfast. We have to know the past if we are to understand the present. So, yes, it is extraordinarily relevant. But it's not just the immediate past, too. Many of our ideas, the concepts that we live with, come from not just 100 years ago or even 1,000 years ago, but thousands of years ago. So much still is actually even Socratic and Platonic from 500 and 400 BC. Ideas have got a very, very long currency. But with Hitler's Daughter, it's probably no accident that it's about stories, because that's where it came from. I read as many oral histories as I could of that time. So Hitler's Daughter is really made up of true stories. It's made up of true stories of the time. One of the greatest compliments I've had are letters, or even people who've come to meet me who lived through those days in Germany. One woman said, but you were too young, you were too young. How did you know? And I knew because I had read the oral histories. I knew because I had grown up with the wreckage of World War II all around me, people who had gone through that time and told the stories of that time. So I was able to combine all of those stories into one story.
That's fascinating because they're stories that are true stories and feeling like true stories even to people who live through it and yet about fictional people.
There is another advantage, though, in writing about it. When you write from oral histories, when you write from other people's stories, yes, you can only put in what is true. You can only put in what can be substantiated. You can only put in what you are reasonably sure is what happened. But, of course, you've also got this other wonderful opportunity. If you don't know what happened on Tuesday, you don't have to include Tuesday. So it's not as though you are actually writing a complete history. With a complete history, if you don't know what happened on Tuesday, you'll probably have to spend the next 20 years trying to find out what happened on Tuesday or put a note in saying, unfortunately, we do not know what happened on that Tuesday. Writing historical fiction, though, you can weave your story around. So if you don't know what happened on Tuesday or you don't know what happened for breakfast, people had for breakfast, then you can actually leave that out. You can make sure your story is accurate. You can make sure it's substantiated. You can make sure it's fascinating. And that is the other thing as well. Writing, for example, about Cook's voyages, writing a history of those voyages, most of them, well, no, they weren't boring, but they were the same thing over and over and over. Faced mountainous waves, faced incredible blizzards, faced breaking masts, faced sails being torn and coming down, faced scurvy. Yes, it was adventurous, but it was the same thing mostly day after day after day for most of the voyage. And that, of course, would make a very, very boring book. In a book, you can say something like 3 months of etc., 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 and you don't have to do every day of what happened.
Yes, so you also write non-fiction about the past, like the Fair Dinkum history series for kids, and you draw on history for your writing about the environment. So when you're writing non-fiction, is there a difference in your approach? Do you start from a different place or do you approach it? Do you write? Is the writing process different for non-fiction and fiction projects?
Yes, very much. As I said, you do have to know what happened on Tuesday, or you have to be honest and say, I don't know what happened on Tuesday. Writing To Let the Land Speak really was the culmination of about 55 years of walking and studying the effect of the land on history, realizing that the greatest player, but the player that we usually leave out, is in fact the land itself. But writing the Fair Dinkum histories, that's really history either for kids or people who know nothing or almost nothing about our history. Now, I thought when I first wrote that it was just going to be for kids. It's only been since they came out I've discovered how many adults are reading them as well, because they have no idea of the story of our nation. And that's really what the Fair Dinkum Histories is. It is the story of our nation, but told as widely as possible. Because most histories are, well, basically dead white men in cities. And with the Fair Dinkum histories, I didn't want it to be just dead white men in the cities, but the story of the whole of Australia from as many points of view as possible, and not focusing even primarily on who was Prime Minister, though that happens to be there, but often the things that affect our lives even more. What we eat, how we eat, the advent of refrigeration, and that how changed the way that we live, having bathrooms, what people wore, did kids go to school. I was trying to focus on the most important things that changed about the way we lived and why they happened. So, yes, there is some politics there, but there's a lot of other things too. There's probably a lot more food, for example, than parliamentary laws put in those books, because the food really had a far greater influence on how we lived.
So they're like social history, the lives of real people, the real lives of real people.
But look, yes, there are prime ministers there too. There certainly are laws.
Not that prime ministers aren't real.
Yeah, well, exactly. It's not that they're not real, and they certainly have got a major influence. Some a far greater influence than others. So they certainly are there. Someone like Billy Hughes, Curtin, etc., had the most profound influence on our history. So, yes, they are there, but there are other things as well. But in the Dignam Histories, I've actually tried to tell it as a story, and I've also tried to keep in the most interesting things, the things that will actually keep people reading it as a story of our nation, rather than go into a lot of analysis. So the two histories that I've written, the Dignam Histories, are really meant to be as absolutely readable as possible, so that someone will pick it up, whether they're an 8-year-old or an 80-year-old. They'll pick up one of those books, they won't be able to stop reading it, and then they'll immediately want to read more of the story of Australia starting 100,000 years ago and going, well, to the update, which ended this year. But with Let the Land Speak is a lot more complex. In retrospect, I probably should have made it 3 books rather than 1, because there is an enormous amount of history and there is an enormous amount of ecology. Mm. And it is the kind of book where people will read one chapter and one subject rather than going on from one to another. So it is a complex book to read, and I would advise people just to read one chapter of it rather than try to digest the whole thing at once.
So when you start, or when you have an idea, do you know, or how do you decide who you want to tell that story to, whether it's a story that could be best told to kids or best told to adults, or, as you said, something that can appeal to any age? Do you know?
I have absolutely no idea. To some extent, it depends on the age of the protagonist. But then, of course, as the book progresses, protagonists can get older. In A Waltz for Matilda, at the beginning of the saga, is 12 years old. At the end of the saga, she's in her 90s. That doesn't really give a terribly good guide as to what the readership is going to be. So that was really up to the publisher. And they decided, looking at the books, that there would be 2 editions of each book. One would be targeted at audiences. One would be targeted at young adults from 12 and upwards. But the only difference in the books would be the cover.
Hmm.
So the adult one comes out first with an adult looking at cover, and then the next year the young adult edition comes out. But the only difference is going to be the cover. Look, some books are very definitely books for young children. There are other books, Lord of the Rings I think is probably one of the classic books of this, that kids as young as 7 are going to love Lord of the Rings as long as someone reads it to them.
Mm.
It's too long and the words are too complex, the sentences are too long and complex for beginning readers to be able to read it to themselves. But the stories, the characters, the ideas, the ideals, the adventure, that is something that very young kids will adore. But of course, it's something that everyone will adore. And most of my books probably fit into that category. Unless they're picked up in the children's section of the bookshop or the library, Adults who pick it up from a trolley probably won't realise that the book is meant to be for a younger audience. They'll assume it's for adults. Most of my books, not all of them, but most of them, are the kind of book that I think just about anyone would enjoy, probably from about 6 or 7 upwards. And that goes for many of the picture books as well. Yes, a 3-year-old will enjoy them, but I hope with something like Diary of a Wombat that an 8-year-old would enjoy it as well. They're not just written for children. They're not just written for adults. I think probably even the majority of good books will appeal to any age group, even if some of them need to be read aloud. Just as Dickens, for example, read his books aloud. They would be very dense reading for many people to read to themselves. But if someone read it aloud with wonderful diction and wonderful expression, then it became mass entertainment.
I'm just thinking too about all those books that kids read together and then pass to one another. Which is one of the delights, isn't it, in writing for kids? You know, sometimes when I go to visit schools and I'm often amazed by how amazed kids are about history and about reading. But they just, we all get to geek out about history. And
okay. Yes, it's one of the things, though, that kids have to be introduced to.
Yes.
I'm very aware of that with my books. There are very few of my books that I think a kid would actually pick up unless they were encouraged to, because they think history is boring. They think it's about, well, dead white men in cities who are doing extremely boring things in extremely boring buildings. It's all about dates and what have you, and it is not going to be interesting. And also my books tend to be longer, and they tend to be more complex, and they tend to have ideas in them. But once they're introduced to the books, either by their teacher or by a friend, then they tend to get hooked. And, look, I think probably 1 in 3 of the letters I get admits that I thought your book was going to be really, really boring until et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then they'll have said that they've read 6 or 8 or 10 or 12 of them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they did have to be introduced to them. They're not the simple ones. And that, too, of course, is where we often lose readers, where people are going to more complex books. We're losing them either when kids go from picture books, and then they're getting very, very simple readers, which, yes, they can read, but they find extremely boring, or else with adults who have just been given very simple books, whether they're the very simple adventure books where one man saves the world from a meteor while hopping on one foot through the Sahara Desert, or there's a love interest where for some reason they don't get together until page 140 and then they do. They're very, very simple books in terms of theme, in terms of plot, with almost no characterization. And people think they don't enjoy books because they have only read very, very simple books. And then they read a complex book, a book that makes them think and feel and imagine, and they are there. And they get caught up in that extraordinary, fascinating, unknown world, and they do not want to leave it, and suddenly you have got a reader. And that can happen at any time. It can happen at 3, at 30, it can happen at 75. I had an elderly neighbour who thought she couldn't read, but she got double pneumonia and she was very, very bored, and I started to read to her. And to her surprise, she found out in the last 50 years she had accidentally learnt to read. And she became captivated. There was this wonderful, extraordinary world of literature that she had never been part of. And she just started eating books up, going to the library at least 2 or 3 times a week to get book after book after book to make up for all that she lost.
Gorgeous. And then she will never stop. She'll be lost in this world forever. Good on her. So you do a lot of work on literacy and encouraging kids especially to love books. Have you got any tips for parents or carers about how to support kids with their reading or kids who think they're not interested in history?
I think give kids permission to read the books that they feel like, but also give them a legitimate choice of books. When they go to the library, and look, a library is essential when kids are finding out the books they want to read, because when they choose books, if they choose, say, 6 books, probably there are only going to be 2 of them that are really going to capture them. Look, I find that when I get books. A lot of them will look interesting, but after 3 or 4 pages, I'll think, no, I really don't want to read this. Or even I'll read half of the book and then think, look, that was wonderful, but I've had enough. And I'll turn to the last chapter and I'll read the last chapter.
And that's okay.
Look, I did that with the last Tim Winton book. It was wonderful. It was like the best pizza I'd ever eaten in my life. But just like eating the best pizza in my life, you don't actually have to eat every slice of it. You can just eat the bits that you want to eat. And it's the same with a book. We need to give kids permission to read the way they want to read. If they want to read in bed, if they want to eat watermelon and get stains on the book, if they want to stop reading halfway through and just find out what happens at the end, they can do it. But particularly when they're learning to find the books that they want, let them take out the largest pile of books possible from the library on your library card if necessary. And if they get a book on bees, don't say, oh, you wouldn't be interested in that. They're probably not going to be interested in bees in 3 weeks' time. They probably won't be an apiarist. But this is what they want to read now. 2 Christmases ago, I was reading to my 3-year-old grandson. Now, we have got a very, very good selection of books for 3-year-olds.
I bet you have.
And for several days, I was reading him books. And he got the idea that I was getting the books from the bookshelves. So he started looking at the bookshelves himself. And then he pointed to a book and said, can we read this, please, Grandma? And it was Snakes and Lizards of Australia. It is a very, very large, extremely large book. It is a book for adults. On every page, you have got 2 snakes or lizards of Australia. It gives you 2 photographs of it in different conditions. It gives you their habitat, what they eat, whether they're egg laying, whether they, et cetera, whether they're diurnal or nocturnal, et cetera, et cetera. They've just got the information. There's a map to show where they live in Australia. And for the next week, that's all we read. We went through the entire book, and he was fascinated, the fact that different snakes live in different parts of Australia, and we're here, and yet Grandma lives here, and Watsit lives here, and these snakes do this, and these snakes do that. That was the book he needed to read. He wanted to read about real things, and he wanted to understand that there were different parts of Australia, the different things lived in different parts of Australia, that there were different kinds of snakes, different kinds of lizards, and they were so different. Last Christmas, he showed no interest whatsoever. He's still got a very, very large drawer of information about snakes and lizards in Australia, which hopefully he'll never lose. But he showed no interest in that book at all. He wanted fiction, and he wanted nice adventurous fiction as well, and we had a lovely time. It was a completely different sort of book. But if he hadn't had permission to find the book he wanted and to lose himself in that book and to keep going as long as he wanted to, I don't think he would have had that fascination. In fact, I know he wouldn't have had that fascination. He'd have enjoyed it, but he would not have had that incredibly fulfilled, just, page after page after page that he absolutely devoured of that book.
And do you remember that feeling? Because you learnt to read quite young, didn't you? Do you remember that? Do you remember feeling that sensation of the first few years of reading?
And a lot of them were historical books as well. Again, the feeling that life was not just this actually rather frightening. I mean, my
childhood was probably about 50% terror, about 40% boredom, and the rest was books. But yes, I remember very clearly. The first one was Bob's. It was about a cat tormented by a mouse, and it began 7 o'clock. Time to get up, said Bob's. Bob's left out of bed, and I love that book so much. I must have been about 2, I think, because my great-grandmother read it to me, and she was the one who looked after me for my first 3.5 years. And I can remember her reading it over and over and then getting sick of it. So I learnt to read it myself because I loved Bob's so much. But the next one I can remember, and again I would have been very young, was Jane Eyre. Mm. Now, I skipped parts of Jane Eyre, partly because the bits about the mad wife terrified me, and other bits because I was young, and a lot of the romance actually bored me, and some of the rest scared me. But nonetheless, I read that book over and over and over, and it was because it was of a different time, and because it was written. Look, it's an historical novel now, but it wasn't at the time it was written. She was writing about the time she lived in. But for me, it was an historical novel, and it was writing about the way people felt then. And also, of course, it had a heroine who, despite everything that happened to her, despite people saying, really, it didn't matter what happened to her because no one cared about her, she had her own integrity, and she did what was right, no matter what other people did around her. And for me back then, that book spoke to me so much. I think I've probably read it at least once a year ever since I was about 6 years old.
Hmm. Yes, it's one of my early influences as well, and one of the things I always, still now when I feel it, the different kind of heroine, the heroine that allows shy girls or people who are overlooked in the world to be yes. the heroines of their own story. And
but also that integrity.
Yes.
Even though the world pays very little attention to them, even though the world doesn't value them in any way, they still know that what they do matters. They need to keep their integrity.
Yes, and how that is a different kind of strength to some of the other sorts of strength we often read in adventure stories, for example.
I think it's probably the greatest sort of strength that there is, where there is no one really to witness that strength, no one to validate that strength, but nonetheless the integrity remains.
And do you think that comes through? I mean, it seems to me that comes through in your writing now, in the things that you write now, and the characters that you create.
Look, I hope so. I would never write to try to propagandise someone to do something. But, of course, all writing reflects the values of the person who is writing. And so, of course, what is seen as good in my books reflects what I think is good. So, yes, they are people of integrity. They are people of hard work. They are people of compassion. They are people who think not necessarily of themselves, but work out what is best for others, not just themselves. They are people who try to do what is right. But as in Hitler's Daughter, going back to that one, that book is really about how do we know what is right, particularly when you are young, when you are 12 years old or 14 years old, like Heidi in Hitler's Daughter, who is in the middle of everything that is bad that is happening in Germany. She is in a house which is sometimes inhabited by Hitler. And yet, even though she is in the middle of it all, she is one of the most ignorant people in the world about what is happening. How do you know what is right and what is wrong when the world around you is insane, when the adults are either telling lies or wrapped up in their own fantasies? How do you know what is good and what is evil when you do know that evil is happening, what can you do? No one listens to 12-year-olds. What can you do when you realise that evil things are happening around you? It's a book that doesn't give the answers because, of course, there are going to be different answers in every situation. But it is a book, I hope, that will show ways to actually ask those questions.
Yes, and the modern part of the story has those runs parallel, doesn't it? And it raises those stories for Mark and the people, the other kids.
It does. It also, I found very interesting that other readers have found things in the book that I didn't know were there. One of the early letters I got was from a boy who came from a school for kids with severe learning difficulties. It was the first book he had read, and he wrote his first letter ever to me about it. He told his teacher he wanted to write me a letter. And the letter simply said, "Dear Jackie French, what I have learnt from your book is to be very wary of anyone who tries to make you angry." Love, James. And he'd got it. I had no idea that was in the book ever since I'd been about 9 years old. I had tried to work out, how did Hitler do it? How did he get so many people to follow him? These absolutely insane ideas. But, of course, he made them angry. It's that wonderful joining of hysteria that brings people together. Look at those rallies of people screaming, "Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil," all of them together. Anyone who tries to make you angry is trying to get power over you. Anyone who tries to make you angry is trying to control you. And particularly for a 14-year-old boy who has got learning difficulties, it's an essential thing to learn. But for every one of us, whether it's a politician, whether it's someone in social media, whether it's a friend, anyone who tries to make us angry means that they are trying to get us to override our intellect and only use emotion, and they're trying to control us. If anyone is trying to make you angry, be very, very suspicious indeed.
So it's wonderful to think of a book like Hitler's Daughter as an antidote to that, as something that asks questions even that the author isn't conscious are there, may not be on the page, but is encouraging particularly younger readers to think,
yes,
to wonder.
There were the same things in the next two books in that series. In Pennies for Hitler, there is a scene where, it's a scene in fact I read out most times I go to schools. It's a scene where the hero is a German boy who idolises Hitler, until his father's students realise that his grandfather was Jewish. They kill his father. Georg must leave Germany, be smuggled out of Germany. He gets to London, but there is the Blitz. He is sent on an evacuation ship to Australia. But Georg cannot exist because he is an enemy. He must pretend to be an English boy, George. And all around him, people are hating. He is an enemy. And then Japan enters the war, and finally there is an enemy he can hate too. But the scene I read is where he can no longer bear the pretense. He has admitted that he is Georg. He has run into the bush. He hears a plane explode above him. He sees a parachute come down, and he sees the parachutist unconscious on the ground. The blood is welling from a cut on his neck. And Georg has a choice. This boy who has lost everything, he has lost his family, his name, his country, his very identity. He can kill an enemy or he can save his life. And I ask the kids, okay, what do you think he is going to choose? He has learnt that hatred is contagious, hatred is powerful. But in Australia, he has also learnt that kindness and cooperation and compassion are powerful too. What do you think is the most powerful? What is going to win for this boy, the hatred or the kindness? What is he going to do? I have probably asked that question now of about 50,000 kids, and there have only been about 8 of them who have said his duty is to kill the enemy. He is going to kill the enemy. The others have all said no. Kindness, eventually, is stronger than hate.
And on that beautiful note of hope, I think, for readers now and readers of the future, we should probably draw this conversation to a conclusion, I'm sorry to say. Can I just ask, though, finally, is that partly why you write so often for kids? Because of that connection that they have with the story and with you, but with the story and with the ideas and their ability to engage with the story in that deep, deep way?
I don't know the answer to that. I do know that I'm increasingly writing books for adults as well as kids. But I do know that the responses from young people mean a lot more to me. I do think our world is in a growing state of extinction. I do think our civilization, our very ecology, the planet that supports life, is in danger. But one of the things that I do try to teach kids, one of the things that I think kids can learn from history, is that every generation faces its own challenges. Humanity is good at climate change. Our ancestors faced the ice ages. They faced the melting of the ice ages where 20 kilometres might vanish under the sea in a night. They have faced worse extinctions, probably, than our grandchildren are going to face. But we have survived. Our human relatives, like Neanderthals, etc., the Denisovians, they didn't survive. We did. Humans are good at challenges. And that is something that I do hope kids get, and adults too, from historical fiction. We are good at challenges. Humanity is not good at boredom. When we are bored, we do stupid things like actually spending all of our money going on luxury cruises or buying far too many clothes and basically shopping therapy. Humans are not good at being bored, and boredom, possibly, is what is destroying our planet. But we are incredibly good at challenges. And if kids face those, if they face those with excitement, if they face them arm in arm with friends, if they know that kindness and compassion matters and working together is a way to achieve things, then there is one thing I can promise. I cannot promise them a perfect world, but I can certainly promise they will never, ever, ever be bored.
And the power of the story.
And definitely the power of the story.
And history.
Look, the story is the way that humans pass information on. It's the way we pass values on. It's the way we actually pass hope on, to say, yes, we survived this. We were here. We got here. And you can do it there. The story is the most powerful weapon that humanity has got.
Well, we are so glad that you are wielding that weapon on our behalf. And it has been an absolute delight talking about historical fiction and so many other things with you today. So thank you so much, and we look forward to seeing you in October.
Lovely to see you then.
Thanks for listening to Imagining the Past. It's a showcase of some of the writers in this year's conference of the Historical Novel Society of Australasia. In Parramatta, New South Wales, from the 25th to 27th of October, the conference offers craft workshops and 2 days of panel sessions, interviews and conversations for writers and readers. You can find the 2019 conference program, book tickets and listen to more episodes of Imagining the Past at hnsa.org.au.